Welcome to Experiences Canada's podcast series from the National Youth Forum 2024 on reconciliation. This podcast series was led by 60 Indigenous and non-Indigenous youth in their own voices. It is the first podcast platform of its kind that provides an opportunity for youth to add their voices to the national dialogue towards truth and reconciliation. Today's podcast explores the science and after effects of discrimination in Indigenous communities and is researched and hosted by Tyson, Malaya, Chloe, Maya, and Zayden. Thank you to Sophia for guiding them through these important conversations and powerful stories so we can learn from their experiences. Please be aware that this podcast includes discussions on injustices and violence against Indigenous peoples in Canada. In the spirit of reconciliation, we aim to increase awareness of these injustices and encourage listeners to actively engage in these tough conversations with sensitivity and respect.
Today, I would like to start off with this land acknowledgement. I would like to thank my Indigenous family and friends who are here and those who are our spirit guides from above. My name is Zayden Testowich-Laclass. I'm 15, and I'm from Treaty 8 Territory from Duncan First Nation.
Hi, I'm Malaya Hart. I'm 15, and I'm from Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Hi, I'm Maya Ryder. I am 17, and I'm from Montreal.
Hi, I'm Chloe Windsor. I'm from Newfoundland and Labrador, and I'm 15 years old. And today, I will be asking these ladies some questions. So, to start off with, Zayden, what does the word discrimination really mean?
Well, to me, in my own language, in the language I was told, it means Kami, Chief, Wanan, Skon, and Kaniwich, which means discrimination in the Cree language. But to me, it means being based off of your ethnicity, your religion, your age, skin, anything like that in life, because you could get discriminated in day-to-day basis life, which isn't a good thing, but we're trying to stop that.
Okay, thank you so much, Zayden. Okay, now for you, Malaya. What are the effects of discrimination?
There is definitely a lot, like, intergenerational trauma,
yeah,
mental health problems, substance abuse, alcohol abuse, you know,
just depression, anxiety,
yeah, eating disorders a lot. Yeah, that's some of the effects of it.
All right, thank you so much. Now, another question for you. Where do these effects come from anyway?
They can come from a lot of different things, like residential school, 60 scoop, you know, any kind of like trauma,
okay,
or like discrimination that happened to them.
All right, thank you. Okay, now for you, Maya, what are the root causes of
discrimination?
Yeah.
Well, for each group, it's slightly different, but it all boils down to a part of the brain called the amygdala, which is the center of emotions. Everything that I'm using here, I got from the paper The Neuroscience of Intergroup Relations by Nina Sakara and Javen Bavel, and I'm going to start with a study by Hart et al. From year 2000. So they did a study where black and white people were separated and shown pictures of each other's faces. The idea being that if the amygdala reacted, it would be in fear towards the out group, so the other group. So white people's amygdalas would react to seeing a black face and vice versa.
Right.
And they found this to be true. This study was flawed in one crucial way, though, and that they didn't anticipate the various stigmas and prejudices that would have impacted those findings. Because one can feel a fear response because they were taught to feel a fear response, and it doesn't say anything about how we are innately as human beings. So a few years later, in 2008, Van Bavel, Packer, and Cunningham did a study where they mixed these groups. Mm-hmm. So they mixed black and white participants and separated them. And each person was given a few minutes to get to know the faces of their group. And when they were shown those faces, there was greater amygdala activity towards that than there was to members of the out-group. So this led them to believe that without any stigmas or prejudices influencing the results from this novel, this new group, they were getting really the bias that we have towards our own in-group, which is basically our clan or our family. Around that same time, a bunch of studies, namely by Cuddy, Fisk, and Glick in 2007, and by Fisk, Cuddy, Zhu, and Glick in 2002, they realized that in four groups, they had to determine two things pretty quickly. Whenever two groups came into contact with each other, they had to see whether they were friend or foe. And to do that, they relied on two factors. So the first one is, are their goals concordant? Like, do they match? Discordant, in conflict with each other, or completely unrelated? And the other is, do they have access to the resources that they would need to follow through with these goals? And as soon as you have a discordant goal, one that is in direct competition with another goal, that triggers another part of the brain and another psychological factor. Fisk et al. In 2002 said that being engaged with another group in a competitive way leads to negative emotions towards them. More studies have shown from the 1990s by Hall, Mullen, Brown, and Smith that being in explicit competition increases hostility, and it also increases conflict and derogation, according to Wirst in 2006, Johnson & Johnson in 1989, and Sheriff in 1961. In fact, when you are in a competitive situation, seeing the pain of a group member, someone who you are cooperating with, triggers the same parts of your brain that process your own pain. So that is really empathy in action. This does not happen, this emphatically does not happen, mm-hmm. when it is a member of the out-group, the competition that is being hurt. In fact, pretty much the exact opposite happens. The parts of our brain that process reward are activated. So to us, when we see our opponent getting hurt, we are rewarded. We feel good about that. And this was discovered by Singer, Simon, O'Doherty, Stephen Dolan, and Frith in 2006. So in short, that would be why we hurt people, why we discriminate against them, because it activates these parts of our brain that produce a pleasurable, rewarding sensation to that. I mean, if you think of sports, when your opponent falls in a sports game, everyone cheers because they didn't get the goal, and that's good for you. That's good for your team. But there is no empathy there. So in order to win, we trip them, we make them fall, we push them down, and at this time, we are rewarded for doing so. And that is something that, at least to the best of my knowledge, after having looked into this, is innately human, which is terrible. Mm-hmm. But there is hope. Namely, multiple studies have shown that group conflict can be extremely malleable. So as soon as you are put in a new in-group, your ties to previous in-groups start to weaken and break down. So from that study from before, when black and white participants were mixed in groups, they didn't have that negative fear amygdala activity, that reaction from seeing in-group members of another race. Whereas if their in-group was described to them as being their own race and the out-group was that other race, they would feel the impact of those prejudices. And groups can develop incredibly quickly. Moments after you are put into a group, you already start to feel that connection, according to Teschfeld and Turner in their multiple studies.
Okay, thank you so much, Maya, for sharing all those amazing facts. I have another little question for you, Malaya. So, I heard that your dad was in a residential school. Can you tell me how that affected you?
Well, it did affect a lot after he passed. When people found out he went, a lot of people wanted me to talk about it and present presentations about it or go to assemblies about it, and that made me very uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's
and
a lot of pressure to put
it on. It is, and at the time, I was not best with my mental health, and that just made it worse because I was still processing that my dad's, you know, gone and stuff, and then obviously having to do, like, process that too, like, not wanting to talk about it either is, like, really hard, you know, like, I don't, it's not my place to talk about it with other people, and, you know, if you can obviously find a residential school survivor if you wanted to talk about it.
So no, it must be really tough to be trying to process this this grief and this mourning, and then to have people like come around you like sharks to try to snatch up as many tidbits of information as they can glean from you.
It definitely affected my mental health more. It just affected it a lot. Definitely with my anxiety and my depression. It really affected that.
For our audience, would you mind explaining what a residential school was?
Residential school was when children from the ages 5 to 18 were taken away from their families and put in the school where they, the quote is, take the Indian out of the child. And they would, you know, cut their hair, burn their clothes, and a lot of other traumatizing things that I, you know.
So first, cut all ties.
Cut all ties with their culture. Yeah. They wouldn't let them speak their language. Practice like any of their culture, you know.
So just try to like shove you into this tight mold and like cut off all the parts that stick out.
Exactly. They want to turn them white in a way, like I was told in like quotes I've seen and talking with other, like my auntie who went to residential school, she used to talk about it before she passed. She was in 2 documentaries about it, and that's what she said. She had a horrible experience, and she talked about it a lot. So, yeah.
I know it's not your place to talk about your father's experience. My question to you is, how do you think, not necessarily your newfound fame, but the interest after the fact that your father was found to be a residential school survivor, would you say that the media's interest in his experience that was put onto you, is that a form of discrimination?
In my opinion, yes, it is, because I feel like they didn't care about it back then before, you know, 2020 when they found, you know, unmarked graves, and then all of a sudden everybody wants to speak to me, and or my mom, which she didn't know anything about it. He didn't tell her anything. Well, maybe a few things, but she doesn't.
It's really
want
hard to talk about traumatic experiences like that. I'm Jewish, and in my school environment, we've been told that there were Holocaust survivors who went through like terrible things and didn't talk about it for years and years and years. And so imagine this like multi-generational system of no one being able to heal because it's just happening for such a long time.
I feel like that is a part of discrimination to me. I don't know what it's like for other people, but for me it is.
Yeah, it's like we white people suddenly felt incredibly guilty, realized we've been doing these terrible things, and then tried to overcompensate massively in this kind of short-sighted way.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing, Malaya. I have another question for you, Zayden.
Yes, of course.
So what was your experience like, and is your experience like, with discrimination?
Well, back in 2018, when my father passed away, and my family and us lived on a reserve called Duncan First Nation on Treaty 8 territory. As we were living there, since my dad had passed, it was just my mom and my brothers and me and my little sisters left. We were kicked off of our reserve because my own reserve would say that we weren't brown enough to stay on the reserve, but we had no reason to stay on the reserve. So we got pushed out we were outed by them. It was like stereotyping us, like as if like we were some of us were too white and some of us were just too dark.
Mm-hmm. That must not have felt good at all. Because you're going through this really difficult time and you'd want support from a community and it's just,
Well, Maya, I have another little question for you.
Yep.
So where can we see competition affecting discrimination in our daily lives?
Well, I talked about sports before. Yes, I would say that's the big example.
Absolutely.
But, my school was very competitive, and I was a little bit victim to this myself, even though I don't like to admit it, but I am an horrible overachiever, and whenever someone got a test score higher than mine, there was a little part of me that I did not like, that was like, darn it! Darn them, like curse them for doing well. And then if their grades fell or they got a really bad test back and I did really well, that like evil part of me would come back and be like, yes, suck on that. That's how it feels, which is not at all fair. And I have a feeling that they did it a little bit too, since they would always ask everyone else what their tests were, and you could sort of see it on their faces whether or not they were pleased that the others had failed. So there is that reward feeling that comes from not knowing that you're better than other people, but the false belief that you have that these school grades make you somehow superior. And it is something that I am still working on.
I have a question for you. I know that this is a podcast about discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
As a Jewish person living in Montreal, how do you experience discrimination?
Well, that's kind of a complicated question. The short answer is, I don't. But not because Jews in Montreal don't experience discrimination. It's because I don't tell anyone I'm Jewish unless I trust them.
And why is that?
Because I'm afraid of discrimination.
Yeah.
I'm worried that, especially with what's going on in the Middle East right now, people will think that I am responsible for that. And I have never been to Israel. I do not vote there. I have nothing to do with their politics. I have never sent them money. And I think what they're doing right now is horrible. But once people find out, sometimes there's like a switch that goes off, that once you think like A is true, it means that B, C, and D must also be true. And so I'm worried about that chain reaction taking place and ruining conversation and just being shut out of a community because I was born into a certain religion.
That's a very interesting point. I know, Zayden, you spoke about this. When stereotypes are lived up to, especially in the realm of education, how does that make you feel when people tell you that you won't ever succeed to a higher post in life?
Well, when I was told by my own family that are literally supposed to be your biggest supporters in the whole world, but some aren't. But they told me that I wasn't going to ever graduate and I wasn't going to end up with any high-end job. They basically said I was going to end up on the streets. I was not going to get nowhere in life, and I was going to end up homeless. But I told them, I turned it around, and I told them that, look at me, look what I did. I only have 2 years left, close to a year, and I passed grade 10 with honors. I'm going to enter grade 11 in the fall. And I proved people wrong. I proved them that I can accomplish things no matter how hard things get or no matter what milestones or something that gets thrown at me. I will fight until I get back up.
I would just like to take a minute to like congratulate you for getting honors because that is amazing. Like round of applause, everyone. Congratulations.
And also another thing too I achieved in life too is last year of July of 2023, I recently graduated my first year of policing cadets in Edmonton, Alberta, the RCMP headquarters. And this year in July, end of the month, I am going to graduate for my second year of policing cadets.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Very interesting point you make. I know we've been talking about stereotyping, a little bit of discrimination.
Yeah.
How do you think, Leia, does this translate into intergenerational trauma as an effect of discrimination?
That is a very good question. I probably had to think about that for a second.
Don't worry, take your time. Yeah, that's your turn too.
Yeah, I think I need to, because that's a really good question. I had to think about that, actually.
Well, I know it's not really in the context of the show that we're producing, but in my family there's also been intergenerational trauma because of the Holocaust. My mom's side were Jewish. Her mom lived in Montreal, so didn't go through that. But on her dad's side, they were living in Poland. My great grandfather, I think we would call that the Big Zadie, but this sounds so weird. So they were all living in Poland, happy-ish life. And my great grandfather's commanding officer, he comes up to him one day, says, "You know, I don't like Jews, but you're all right. Get the heck out of here. The Germans are coming. Nothing good is going to happen. Get your family. Get out of here. Like, right now." So they fled into Russia, and they were in displaced persons camps, and eventually they made it to Canada. But my family has always had some trouble because of this. Even on my bubby's side, just like little remarks about, oh, you're not good enough, you have to succeed, you have to do well, you have to do better. Things about, like, eating all the food left on your plate. Things about making sure you're dressing in the right clothes, that you're talking in the right way. Just all adding up into this sort of cloud or shroud of negativity that you wear like a cloak. And it is not easy.
Yeah. I'm so sorry.
Oh, it's all right. My parents are pretty healthy.
That's good. For me, well, like, half my family went to residential school. Like, my dad obviously went, and then his siblings, I had to think about this. I had an Auntie Lina, Ellie, then a Johnny, it's hard to think about it, actually.
Yeah.
We had a Melissa who didn't go. We're thankful, but she had unfortunately passed away due to, I think, substance abuse. Not sure. That's our main cause. And we have Auntie Lorna and Auntie Myra. And those five, whatever the ones I mentioned, went to residential school. And when they got out, this affected them a lot, with my Uncle Johnny especially. He started drinking a lot, substance abuse, and he ended up having children, which that affected them too. And they eventually got his habits of drinking, and they're better now, gratefully, like so grateful.
Yeah.
But my Uncle Johnny's still struggling. Mm-hmm. And with my dad, you know, I'm adopted, so my dad had children. Obviously, my uncle, I call them uncles, my Uncle Danny, he got affected by this, I think, we're not sure, but he had substance abuse and a lot of that, and it got passed to three of my cousins, Amara, Nessa, and Daniel. And my cousin Daniel died in 2019, I think, due to substance abuse of that too, because he was really close with my dad, and he saw his trauma, and then when that obviously got passed down to my Uncle Danny, he saw that trauma too, and he got really depressed seeing that, and so he chose the life of drugs and stuff, which he ended up overdosing on accident.
Mm-hmm.
Fentanyl.
Yeah.
And he ended up dying because of that. So, and then that really affected my cousin Amari and my cousin Nessa, who I'm not sure what Nessa's doing anymore. But my cousin Amari wants to make a change like me.
Okay.
She has two jobs working with Indigenous children. She recently got a job where she could travel through different reserves to help with residential schools and help like research about it. And she's in social work at the University of Manitoba now. And she's doing a lot better. You know, I know she struggled a lot, but she's overcome it now. She's trying to become a therapist.
Ooh.
About it. And she's, you know, yeah, a lot. And with the other churches from the Auntie Myra, you know, they just kept it to themselves. So obviously their children, you know, they still suffer a lot. But I think, not trying to like, this sounds really bad, but like, they've said it to me too, that they don't, you know, they struggle a lot, but not as bad as my Uncle Danny or my dad and stuff, or my Uncle Johnny, because my Uncle Johnny went to a day school where he told me, he wants me to tell everybody that he got abused and stuff there, and other stuff that he does not like to say. Like, he says, you can mention it, but I don't want to due to respect for him, because I don't know if he truly does or if he's just being nice. So I'm not going to mention all this stuff. And then with my Auntie Lina, she started talking about her experience because she said before she died she didn't want her children to live down that trauma. She wanted a better life for them. So she started talking about her experience. You know, she wanted to overcome it. So she was in one movie about it. I can't remember. We Were Children, I think it's called, two documentaries. And she devoted her life to that, talking about residential school. And she really wanted to put that out there. But then she unfortunately passed away from cancer in, I think, 2015. But I know she'd be proud of, like, what's happening now with it. And, yeah, that's really...
Yeah.
I feel like there's a lot of trauma in my family. And I'm trying to overcome it, too. You know, I feel like... Yeah, a lot of stuff has happened to me as well with that. You know, seeing my dad struggle a lot was really hard on me. And definitely with my biological dad, because my family is really confusing. So my adopted dad, his son Doug is actually my dad. So technically my grandpa adopted me. So, and I still had contact with my biological dad, and he had a lot of trauma too. And it was, you know, he saw me every couple years, and I feel like I just got really close to him before he died. And I feel like he put a lot on me too, you know. He was not a good person. He wasn't at times, but he loved to trauma dump on me, and I feel like that really put me on the spot sometimes, and it really messed up my mental health there, because I felt guilty too, even though I know it wasn't my fault. I just felt really guilty, and then after he died, I felt this guilt, like, I felt like it was my fault he died, you know, weirdly, even though he died from a heart attack, so it was, like, completely natural. Like, I don't know what happened. Oh, God, it's like...
Did you feel guilty that he had to suffer didn't have to?
Yeah, that made me feel guilty, and I got...
That's called survivor's guilt. One of the cruel ironies of... trauma is that you bottle it up inside, and sometimes it just comes out, but when it comes out, it's too much.
Yeah.
And you can end up hurting other people. But to lighten your own load, you really have to share it. But by having to share it, if you don't have enough people or a community around you to share it with, then you can't.
Yeah. So
you can end up passing it on in a different way.
I guess so, yeah. I never really thought about it like that, but yeah. But my adopted dad, he never really wanted to put that trauma on me, and he wouldn't like that my biological dad was doing that to me, because he died before my biological dad. But he never wanted that trauma put on me, neither to my mom, and I never told my mom because I felt ashamed, you know, that I was feeling like that.
I'm not ashamed anymore. Don't be ashamed.
Well, yeah, so I didn't want to tell her. I was really kept quiet. I would stay in my room all day, and I stopped going to school. I would lock myself in my room and kind of just feel guilty. Yeah, survivor's guilt, I guess, yeah. So, so then I ended up failing a bunch of classes, and right now I'm trying my best again, because I think I know that's what everyone would want from me, and people have said it to me that you could really make a change, and especially with this trip, my cousin sent me in. She's like, you have to do this. You know, your dad would be proud if you did this. And I was like, you know what? I didn't want to do it at first, because I was like, I don't know if I can do that yet. And then she sent it to my mom, which she, like, begged me to do it. She like, is like, please, please do it. You know, you'd make our family so proud if you did this. You can, like, do, like, talk about their experience if they want. And, yeah, I think that really helps.
Well, I have to say that I'm glad you're here with us. Yeah. Because it's really been a pleasure really getting to know you.
Yeah, I think it's so fun. Now, and I'm definitely better. You know, I started going to school. I started getting my grades up. I'm probably going to be held back a year because of that. But honestly, I'm fine with that, you know. But, yeah, I'm fine with that now because I'm in a better place. I talk to teachers. I have a therapist now, and I'm just doing so much better. And I feel like all my family is trying their best now to do better about that. So, yeah, I'm kind of happy now, in a happy place. Same with my family.
Okay, thank you so much, Malia, for sharing all that. I really appreciate that. For you sharing that.
It means a lot that you were able to trust us. Really, really and it's going to help people to hear your story and to know that they're not alone.
Yeah, that's what I hope for, to be honest. That's another reason why I came here.
Absolutely. So I know me and you interviewed this lovely woman earlier. We were discussing discrimination. Lorraine Singer, who is a nurse, who worked in the 60s up north. How did you find that interview?
I found it really inspirational, actually. I think Lorraine is a really lovely woman.
Absolutely.
And she explained it really nice. And she's really funny, too. And she knows how to, like...
She knows how to
She
talk.
Knows, like, she's a very bubbly person.
She was a great
talker.
She
definitely knows how, like, you know, make it, like, happy. Like, not, like, happy, like, make the more positive around.
Yeah. All right. So, on that note, Chloe, Malia, and Lorraine, take it away.
Hi. So, I'm Malia, and...
I'm Chloe, and we are both with Experience Canada,
and we're going to interview you today.
Yes, would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is Lorraine Singer, and I'm honored and thrilled to be part of this conversation.
So, what did you do for your job?
I'm a nurse by training. I taught nursing for 35 years at a community college in Montreal. And one day there was a letter on my desk because we used to get all kinds of advertising, and they were looking to have somebody who was bilingual, English, French, who could work with the French consultants who couldn't speak English because the contract was to work with the Inuit population and develop programming there.
With working in Indigenous communities, have you seen any children with obvious trauma and not know how to deal with it?
Yes, there were many children. I worked in many different communities. So there was one group of children who had mothers who had been drinking alcohol while they were pregnant. And the native communities have a different biochemistry. So their ability to metabolize alcohol is much different from people like who were not native. And that became a big issue in the north with these children. They were challenged in many ways, and they were very apparent in the communities that I worked in.
What are some of the effects you've seen in your work over the years, and like how do you resolve them?
Okay, well, one of the experiences which I shared with Sophia was when I was a student nurse, which is 65 years ago, a long time ago, we used to have children sent to Montreal to a communicable disease hospital. And they were sent because they had TB, which we introduced from the south into the north into these native communities. So these little kids would come down with TB, and they would be placed in an iron lung to help them breathe. And they lived in this iron lung sometimes for many, many months. But the other thing that was, I thought, quite terrible was the hospital that I worked in didn't use the names of these children as they were named in their communities. They were given a number. That, to me, is quite dehumanizing because your name is part of your identity. The fact that their name had been taken away in this way and has been used in war situations and other situations, which I thought was very traumatic, really traumatic. There was a boat, Canadian boat, called the C.D. Howe. And the C.D. Howe had X-ray equipment on board. So they'd take the kids who were playing at the water's edge and X-ray them. And if they had TB shown in the X-ray, they would just take them without telling anybody and send them down to the hospital, which is quite, imagine, your kid disappears, right? And then years later, when they're better, they were sent back into the community, obviously having lived a number of developmental years in the South here in Montreal, and they reappeared in families that didn't know what had happened to them. So that was a challenge, you know, for everybody. And these kids sometimes had a very hard time finding their way back into the community. The fact that they had lost their identity was a number, was another dehumanizing thing, and quite awful. But my experience, I had an interesting experience because one of these children that I had looked after, having had TB in Montreal, many years later, I did consulting developmental work in these communities. And one of these children that I had looked after as a child became my interpreter because while they were in Montreal, they learned English. And when I went up to do a project where we had to develop language, because the doctors would come from Montreal to provide health services in the communities. And, you know, when you go to the doctor, they do a head-to-toe assessment. So they ask you about different parts of the body. And there was not language in the native language in Inuktitut for some of the parts of the body. So one of the projects that I had was to develop language, which had to be agreed upon by anybody who would be using it. That means the healthcare provider from the South and the native people who didn't speak anything other than their native language. And so the bridge was an interpreter. And one of these interpreters was a young woman that I had looked after as a child in Montreal when she had TB. And she learned English, and she became my bridge, my interpreter, between myself, who's there to do language development, and the native population. So that was a really interesting experience, and we were very successful. We developed language. They also provided me, at the time, with an old man who was very Asian. He was in his 80s. His name was Tamasi Khumak. And language being a living entity, he knew language from his generation. But what was special about him was that he was computer literate. He was the son of a whaler and somehow had stayed abreast with development and was computer literate. So he's a great resource to the group. And he helped us build this new language based on old language and what we needed for the task at hand. So that was really, it was a wonderful, wonderful project.
Yes, it definitely is. Well, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Right. How has all of this negative discrimination that's happened over the years affect you, your life, and your mental health? And does it still affect you to this day?
Well, I think it made me very sensitive. Through my experience working with these generations, you know, their lives have changed and Native populations in these decades, we're talking about 50 years ago or 60 years ago, the world has changed. The communication between the South and the Native communities has evolved and is not quite as discriminatory as it was. There's a wonderful leadership coming from the Native communities, very, very talented people who are more leaders than just having been done to, as it was in the day. So the exposure to that, first of all, it exposed me to beautiful Canadian North. I met some fascinating people when I was there. And it showed me how significant it is to be caring and kind and listen and understand people who have different experiences. So it's enriching. And I'm a people person, and I enjoy being with people who have different stories and different life experiences.
Yes.
That's amazing. What is some advice you would give our youth to become a better future?
For a better future? I think that communication between people is probably the best tool that we have. And to do that, I was out the other night. I was on a board for a school of children who have learning challenges. And I had the same conversation with people there. And we decided there was a neuro-linguistic PhD at the table who studies neurology and how we're wired and how we learn and so forth. And some of the things that we talked about is that teachers often tell. They don't ask. Rather than asking the question and hearing what the other person has to say, which offers them a presence in the conversation and their identity as who they are in that moment. But if you're going to tell them because you have a message that you want them to get, then you've already shut them down, you know. And so my takeaway from all of that is in communication, it's an effective tool is to use asking more than telling, which, as I said, provides the opening for an exchange. It's always, you always have the moment to respond, but if you give the other party the opening, then you're already opening up the whole opportunity for what you can exchange.
Very true. Perfect. Thank you for being here. Really.
Oh my goodness. I feel so honored to be part of your conversation.
All right. Well, thank you, Chloe, Malaya, and Lorraine for sharing all of these wonderful words with us.
Absolutely.
Zayden, would you like to take this opportunity to talk a bit more about your experience with discrimination, maybe specifically in child services?
Yes, of course. Well, it's kind of a hard topic to talk about, but like I'll still talk about it because like, I want people to know my story. I want them to know how it feels and how I felt in there. So after my dad passed away, after my mom and us moved, we got involved with child services, and me and my four younger siblings were taken away for a good 3 years from my mom and uncle. So my mom and them were fighting like the courts and everything because there was allegations like against us that weren't true, so we were taken in. And child services, when we stayed with them, they would move us like home to home to home. And most of the families we were with them, they weren't with our reserves. They weren't with family. They were with non-Indigenous people we did not know. We did not go to powwows. And they would try and cut our hair there, just like as if it was a residential school, like all over again. And I know, like, just like how we were told earlier about residential schools, I know, like, I understand all that stuff like that because I do have family that went through it. And same with my Uncle Wes that my mom's with. He also went to a day school, and they also, but as his day school, they stayed overnight, though, as well. And his generational trauma went on to me, and then as we went into the foster system, that generational trauma also went on to us, of us going through that same thing. Because the system is just the repeat of the same thing of a residential school, basically, just not as much as what was happening, like the abuse, the physical, and all that. It's just most likely you get taken from your family up until you're 18. And, yeah, they, like, They just take you away from your family. You don't get to see your family as much. And sometimes, like, when you try and contact your family, they'll even take your phone away. They'll take every contact away that you could contact your family.
Wow, that's and they really will not let you contact them. That's really like the residential schools.
And that is what happened to me when they said I wasn't allowed to talk to my own birth mother. I would call her and text her every horrible thing they would say behind my mom's back about my mom. And I would stand up for her saying she was a good mother, that she kept going after my dad died no matter what my mom was trying for us.
I have a follow-up question for you. Do you think that the over-policing, shall we say, of child services in Indigenous communities is informed by discrimination, is informed by stereotypes, and how does that make you feel?
Well, to me, it's just like the foster system. I wish they had more of a mindset, like, where they would let us children be free how we want. Like, we see our family, have that connection to our culture still, and living within our home communities or near them at least, and not like 8 hours or like a plane ride across the world where we can't even contact our family. I just would like the system to change, and I'd like them to be more straightforward and to be understanding Indigenous families. And that's why, like, when I'm older, I want to try and be a social worker. If I don't become a police force within Edmonton or so, I will go to social work around in college if I graduate, and I'm going to go to university for a few years.
That's amazing.
Knowing how resilient you are, I can't really speak to this because it really depends on what you do, but in my opinion, I don't think it's an if you graduate. I think it's when you graduate.
It's when you graduate.
Yeah.
And also when you change the world, because yes. You will.
Mm-hmm. That's why we're here.
Thank you.
And I don't, well, no one can see this because this is a recording, but could you just read us what's written on your shirt?
Yes, it means MMIW and 2G, 2+ as well, which means it stands for Our Missing and Murdered Indigenous Girls and Two-Spirited People, which means every year on May 5th, we have a thing called the National Woman Day, where you wear red for women and girls, even boys too, that are Indigenous, that either get murdered, they get raped, assaulted, or they just go missing or stolen, and half the time they don't come back home. When we get them home, we find them within like a condition like they're no longer here, and they are gone to the spirit world, which is really sad.
Can I ask you a follow-up question? Because I know that you're interested in possibly joining the police force in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls is a massive cause. Do you think the police's lack of focus on cases like this is fueled by discrimination against Indigenous peoples?
Most cops that I know, some cops are good, some cops are not. There could be bad cops and good cops or people sometimes. But for me, in my community where I live, I feel like the cops haven't done much, because these last recent 6 years, coming up actually here in a few days, it will be 7 years since my cousin, my dear cousin Shaylin, her son and her daughter were only 3 and 2 when she went missing right after work, and she got picked up, they said, from someone, and after that, she went missing, and we haven't found her body and nothing, but after that, people were telling us stories, like, she was getting hurt, and she was being fed to wild animals out on a farm that wasn't far from where she lived. And after that, other people were saying she was taken half across the world and she was being trafficked. But the thing is, I know Shaylin would not leave her babies like that. Shaylin was never like that. She loved her kids so much. She would go to work, she'd come home, she'd see Tyson and Selena. She'd go back to work, come home to them, and then her Nana and her Papa would watch the kids while she went to work. But one night, she didn't come home. And that's when we got a call. She went missing just outside Fairview at an A&W restaurant where she worked. And when I asked the cops to help and help and help look, they have not gone anywhere. The only track they have is from her leaving the restaurant. So I know something behind that. I feel something suspicious is behind that. Someone's covering up something, and I know the truth will come out soon. And I know hopefully we will get justice and see her soon. And we'll get to bring closure to our family.
Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Now, clearly we know that this is an issue that we've had for a long, long time. And it continues to persist within our Canadian culture today.
Most unfortunately.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Would you like to lead us into the solutions?
All right. Well, yesterday, as a team, we took the liberty of trying to figure out some possible solutions to this highly pervasive issue that has been going on for years. The biggest one that we found was education. People need to know what happened. People need to know the effects of it. They need to know the consequences. And they need to know how they can do better. There needs to be an indigenization of the education system, because right now it's sort of taught as though, well, they were here before us, and then the colonizers came, and then at least in my history curriculum, we sort of stopped talking about it. With like, history switched completely from like, here's the difference between a teepee and a longhouse, to, well, they've disappeared, so let's focus on the colonizers. According to the Honorable Justice Murray Sinclair, who is chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, education got us into this mess, and education will get us out of it. But we did talk about a few other ones. As you will see in this interview that I did with Melanie Muhammad.
All right, so I am joined here today by Melanie Muhammad online. Would you like to give us a brief overview of what you do?
Of course. So my name is Melanie Muhammad, as you noted. I am a Director General at the Federal Department of Canadian Heritage. I am specifically responsible for programs that support community building and youth. And so I oversee 4 grants and contributions programs that help people in Canada celebrate local history and heritage, learn about the history of the country and the diversity of stories that make the fabric of our country, as well as 2 programs that help youth come together in common cause to engage in leadership initiatives, as well as to participate in exchanges with one another from different parts of the country so that they get a feeling for what it's like to be in a different part of the country. I also have the Federal Youth Secretariat within my area, and they are responsible for advancing the implementation of Canada's youth policy, reporting regularly and periodically on the state of youth in Canada, and then serving as the secretariat to the Prime Minister's Youth Council, which is a forum where youth are able to engage with government decision makers and policy makers to influence and to bring to bear issues that affect them in their lives.
All right. Sounds like a really cool job.
It's definitely fun, yes. It's I very much enjoy being a public servant, and this particular job is very fulfilling, very enjoying.
Excellent. Where do you see discrimination take place in your work?
So discrimination, I think, it's not just unique to a workplace context. I would definitely say that I see discrimination happening throughout society, throughout all facets of society. myself as a racialized person, as a woman, I also experienced firsthand discrimination from people who just, from my perspective, may not have an understanding of the differences or may not appreciate the differences between different human beings. I've studied in the area of public ethics, including around identity politics, and so I have an understanding, certainly not more profound than a scholar such as my professor, but certainly I have a greater appreciation and understanding for the reasons why, as humanity, as a collective human race, we still engage in discrimination towards the other. And so it's something that it's lessons that I'm able to then carry forward into my personal work as the Director General at the Department of Canadian Heritage, but then also to help promote inclusion and equality for everybody.
So this is something that you are pretty familiar with in both a personal and professional setting.
I would say so, yes.
So, my team and I, we have done the very hard work of brainstorming possible solutions, none of which are perfect, but hopefully all of which have some sort of place in a discrimination-limited future. So, the big one is education, but other than that, we also have socialization to different groups, as well as exposure to them. Policy to help eliminate discrimination on a legal basis, and sharing these resources that everyone has the promise of our country of an equal opportunity access. This destigmatization of education and of the professional work. So making sure that everyone is aware that every job and every person has a place within our society and a role to play in that place that is important for the structure of our community and our nation. So, are these other ones good?
I think those are all really great examples. I think it's really interesting, it's really heartening for me that as a team, you've gone towards the psychological and behavioral approaches to mitigate discrimination. You talked about training, and so implicit bias, or unconscious bias as it's sometimes called, has thankfully become more common, and so folks are able to engage in different ways of noticing the patterns and the automatic snap judgments that they're making in their brain, and then take the time to be able to slow down, take pause, and then make a more informed way forward or way of engaging in that particular situation. I think as well as the foundation of many of the solutions you've talked about are about promoting empathy and perspective taking. You're talking about facilitating dialogues on diversity and the richness that's brought through diversity of people. And so I think that those are all really great ways to help to foster solidarity and reduce prejudices that because they help foster meaningful interactions between diverse groups. I think from a more institutional or perhaps a bigger perspective is around our international human rights commitments as a country. So Canada is a signatory to numerous international human rights treaties, including the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination and the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. These commitments then inform Canada's domestic human rights policies and practices. So, for example, the Canadian Human Rights Act is a federal piece of legislation that was enacted in 1977, and it prohibits discrimination based on factors such as race, national or ethnic origin, sexual orientation, gender identity or expression, marital status, disability, and then most recently, genetic characteristics. And this This statute applies at the federal level within organizations that fall within federal jurisdiction. But then to bring that down to a provincial territorial level, we have provincial and territorial human rights codes. And so each province and territory in Canada has its own human rights legislation that very much in many ways mirrors the federal legislation, the Canadian Human Rights Act. They protect against discrimination in housing, in services, employment, and so on. And then
It seems like we already have put a lot of policy in place to sort of help this along. So the real future work is going to be in the actual people, the population.
Yes, absolutely. Identity is something that's inherent and it's unique to humanity, to humans, to society and civilization. And so in the very way that it's humans, it's our brains that perpetuate discrimination and prejudice, it's by our own efforts that we're going to be able to mitigate that and to make sure that we foster equality and inclusion for everybody.
And in yourself, gigantic challenge, an obstacle, this path that we have embarked on. Do you think that that Canada as a country is sort of headed in the right direction?
I definitely think so. I'm proud to be Canadian. I am the first generation in my extended family to be a Canadian citizen. And for me, Canada is very much the country that welcomes diversity, that celebrates diversity. In many ways, we are among the countries that have the strongest human rights records. We're certainly not perfect, but I do believe that we are on the right track. As I mentioned, we have legislation and then policies and other protective measures that stem from that at the federal, provincial, and territorial levels. Through programs, for example, like those that I administer, but also others that my colleagues at the federal level, as well as, again, at the provincial, territorial, and municipal level, we support community-led initiatives that aim to raise awareness about issues like racism, gender discrimination, and the rights of 2S LGBTQI plus people. And so I think in those ways, we're mobilizing each other and as a society to be able to take steps forward. And I think we are going in the right direction. We simply have to keep moving, maintain our momentum.
So if you're ready to pass the fight along to future generations?
Absolutely. The next generation, and something that I've learned a lot through my engagement with Indigenous peoples, with First Nations peoples, is around the concept of taking actions today in a way that will positively benefit the next seven generations. And so myself, in the work that I do as a federal public servant, I am very mindful of the generations that will come after me, including yours. And I believe firmly that you as a generation as well, a generation of youth leaders, are going to be doing the very same thing, thinking about how the actions that you take today will benefit future generations. And so I definitely have a lot of hope and a lot of optimism invested in this latest generation.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your words and your time.
Thank you for having me.
And also along with that, about the missing Indigenous women and Two-Spirited as well, and the non-Indigenous as well. When non-Indigenous population goes missing, they're most likely to be found 80% more than Indigenous people are found.
Wow, that is a striking statistic.
Mm-hmm, because most likely they say, like the cops, like when someone says, oh, like, a non-Indigenous person went missing, I need them found, the cops get right onto it. And within like a couple of days to a week, they find them and they're alive. They're okay.
I read a book a while ago in class, and it was talking about missing Indigenous women. And it gave the example that hours after a white child goes missing, It's on the news. It is everywhere. We get Amber Alerts. Like, they make sure we know.
Yeah.
But when an Indigenous person goes missing, most often it doesn't make the news. Not everyone in the population is immediately alerted. And there isn't a huge hurry to go and save that poor sweet child.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just recently, and actually this happened in BC, in Dawson Creek, BC, along a river, there was a man testing out the water for a scientific thing. And what he really found wasn't what he was looking for. He actually found two Indigenous women that were missing, and they were gone. They were passed on, and he called the RCMP emergency right away. When they got there, they said that they were out there for at least the max of 4 months, left there. They were beaten, they were physically raped and emotionally hurt. And recently, that was also part of my family too. So we got to, I wasn't there because I came here, and they laid her to rest, both of them, right after I came here to Ottawa. They laid her to rest in Dawson. So now they have her in a beautiful place where she always loved to go, or both of them loved to hang. And the thing about it, which is sad, is both those two Indigenous girls that were found were cousins.
And it seems like they were found completely by accident, right? It wasn't after months of rigorous searching. It was just some guy who happened to be in this place at either the wrong or the right time, depending on how you look at it.
Can I add something real quick?
Of course.
So, I can't remember their names right now. It's all fuzzy. But recently in Manitoba, there was a serial killer killing Indigenous women. And I think someone named Mercedes, an unknown woman, which we gave the name Buffalo Woman. Mm-hmm. I think someone with the last name Harris, I cannot remember their first name.
That's okay.
And they were murdered by him. I'm not sure if they were raped or anything, but they could not find their bodies whatsoever. They only had clothes and DNA off of him. And everyone thinks they're in the landfill. So they've been protesting at the landfill since it happened. I think 2 years ago, was it? 2 years ago, they've been camping out the landfill, and there's at the historical site, the Forks, they've been had a camp out. But I think he said he killed them because he enjoyed doing it. He did not like Indigenous people. He would go out to the homeless shelter and, you know, do it. And I think it came out that he had killed 13 more women that they just found. And I think he's killed maybe more that he's not admitting. But recently, the premier of Manitoba, Wabkinew, who, fun fact, is the first Indigenous man to become a premier, and I had the chance to meet him and talk about it with him, and it was amazing. He recently passed the thing to search the landfill, and they're still camping out right now, because they're not going to move until they search it, until they find the bodies. And that's really what's been happening in Manitoba lately. And I just really want to, like, put that out there, because I really want people to acknowledge that what's happening there too. And I want them to get justice as well, as your cousin too. So I'm so sorry about that too.
Yeah. Also too, I don't know if much people know this about the city of Grand Prairie, Alberta, but there is actually a highway just outside of Grand Prairie, and it is called the Highway of Tears. There is also a book named after it. And the reason why they call it the Highway of Tears is most Indigenous women were found there that were missing. They were found in the ditches along. And also, too, how we brought them back home, their spirits. Every time we went to Grand Prairie, we would go before NMIW Day. And we'd wear red, and we would walk all the way from Grand Prairie, and we'd walk all the way back to Peace. And we bring them home, because red, that's the reason why we wear red. Mm-hmm. When the spirits go into the spirit world, they don't see much colors.
But the reason why they see red, it's so bright, the color, it means passion, it means love. You're caring for someone and you're holding a strength no one knows how to hold all the time. And
thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting when you talk about the serial killer, you talk about the fact that he stated quite publicly that he hates Indigenous people.
Yeah.
And we spoke previously during Maya's section that this hate is something that we're taught.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And that's why education should be at the forefront of the solutions, especially because I'll lead on to you now for solutions. But you did speak about previously that it's nature.
Yes.
I'll let you finish the quote.
Nature is what makes us like us, but it is nurture that makes us hate them. And I don't say the word hate lightly, but I think that's really what it is, because hate comes from a passion and what is going on here. There are emotions involved. This isn't someone who liked killing people. This is someone who wanted to kill Indigenous people specifically because they hated them. So, as I mentioned with Melanie, I'm just gonna restate it here. Education was the big one, but there was also socialization, exposure, good policy, even though it sounds like we have some of that, but we really need it to be more all-encompassing and better. The redistribution of resources, the destigmatization of certain biases and prejudices, things that we think are not okay now, that comes from my way of life, not your way of life. And both are okay.
Yeah,
like, I can be a super competitive student. You can be a super competitive student. We can compete together.
It could be your own unique self. It's being your own way. Just like in Cree. And how we say it is, we rao kinam. It means you be you. Let them be them. Be yourself. Don't let them beat you. Don't let their words hurt you. You got this. You can do it.
I love that. Them. That is beautiful. Yeah, everyone has their place in our society. And it is high time that we not only tolerate, but accept all of the different lifestyles and ways of being that all these cultures in this, I'm going to say, wonderful country, when they come together, it's really good.
That's what Canada is, about being multicultural and accepting everybody. That's a place we pride ourselves on. I think
yes.
We pride ourselves on.
Yeah, we have to live up to that promise.
Exactly.
Experiences Canada, providing young Canadians with once-in-a-lifetime experiential learning opportunities since 1936. Learn more by visiting experiencescanada.ca and follow us on social media at Experiences Canada. Thank you to Youth Ottawa for partnering with us for the production of these podcasts, and thank you to Canadian Heritage for funding Experiences Canada's first ever in-person forum towards reconciliation.